Yes, you're listening to a new episode of Basgasten, the podcast in which I interview well-known Dutch, Belgian, and international bass players about their gear, career, and the people that have made them into the bass player they are today. Basgasten is powered by The Bassist, the magazine for the Dutch and Belgian bass player. And in this episode, my guest is Damian Erskine. You might know Damian from his work with Gino Vannelli, his excellent column on the website No Treble, and his educational books and videos. And I spoke to Damian during the coronavirus lockdown.
Dat was de Bas. Last year, and so we were going to be playing some of the festivals and just a few gigs around the area.
Cool. So,
and then hopefully we'll get to do it again soon. I may be back there in late October with Gino Vannelli.
Oh, cool.
Assuming everything works out.
Yeah, you never know. They're going to have some new regulations on Tuesday, I think.
Constantly shifting paradigm.
Oh yeah, and I read that in all the Dutch mayors were like, okay, let's cancel everything until September 1st.
Wow.
And there are even people that say, okay, let's go all the way and go October 1st.
Wow. Yeah, I imagine that'll just keep moving around. I think it's going to be years before things get truly back to normal, you know, with economies and everything.
Yeah, well, I'm first like worried about when somebody's going to do something on a stage again, like with an audience.
Yeah. And yeah. It's unbelievable. I mean, as it is, all of the festivals are canceled for the summer. So, and I'm sure a lot of the clubs might not be able to survive this downtime. So we'll see what things look like even once we can get back together.
Yeah. And how, like, with audiences being 5 feet apart or 6 feet or, how that's going to work out.
Yeah, it's going to be strange. We'll have to just wait and see, play it out.
Yeah. I'm in the meantime trying to go live on my Facebook page. I think that's working. Preparing live stream preview. So I'm recording this and then streaming it at the same time.
Okay.
So it's going to be live on my page, and then I'll be uploading it as an episode of my podcast in, I think.
Yep.
3 weeks?
We are live.
No, maybe more. No, 3 weeks.
Cool. Beautiful.
But let's see if people are going to watch it. They probably will.
I hope so.
I hope so, too. So, Damian, it's a great, great honor to have you as a guest. And
thank you for having me.
It's a bit weird because we were supposed to meet in May, when you were going to be in Holland for a little while to play with some guys, and then, you know, everything collapsed and got canceled, and so I was like, let's do this over Zoom in this case. And you were happy to
I'm glad we could work this out. I was looking forward to it. So
yeah, definitely. So how is life in Portland, Oregon with nothing going on?
It's surreal. Thankfully the weather's been really nice. Normally this time of year it could still be raining every day, and it's actually been fairly warm and sunny, so been able to at least leave the house and walk around and hang out in the yard. I'm sorry?
Are you still allowed to go outside?
We're still allowed to go outside. Everything's pretty much closed. But we're allowed to walk around, and the official parks are closed. But a lot of the, you know, local park areas are still open, although they tend to be so crowded full of people. I tend to just kind of stick to the streets, and traffic so light it's not an issue. But yeah, just been taking walks, and I've been getting super productive at home, giving myself a few projects, so we're keeping busy. And I'm kind of an introvert naturally anyway, so I've been enjoying the downtime. I was very busy for quite a while, so I've actually just been enjoying being at home and hanging out with my wife and getting work done around here.
Great. So in Holland, we have this rule that you're supposed to be 5 feet apart from each other at all times, except for the people you live with. Do you have a similar rule there?
Yeah, we have a 6 foot rule here.
Wow. And do they really enforce it?
I mean, as much as you could enforce something like that, you know, of course, when you finally need to go to the grocery store, you try and stay as far apart from everybody as you can, but you know, you have to pass each other in the aisles still, so it is what it is.
It is what it is. So you've been busy at home. I mean, I was reading up on you, and I read you took a hiatus from your weekly column at No Treble because you were so busy. So is it still like as busy as it was then? And what are you up to at the moment?
Well, I mean, not busy traveling or gigging, that's for sure. But since the quarantine, I've used the opportunity to pick up on a lot of projects I just haven't had time to do and have put on the back burner. I recorded a 2-hour video companion for one of my books, Right Hand Drive, which I launched a week ago or so. Mm-hmm. And I've started a new website actually, which hasn't launched yet, but I've been plugging away, called baseeducation.com, and I've just been filming all kinds of brand new content for that. It's just basically going to be a lesson website and a place where I can, a portal for all of my educational materials, whether it's worksheets and charts and everything I've used for clinics or just, you know, some interesting live footage, but a ton of instructional videos as well. So I've really just been plugging away at that, learning how to use Final Cut Pro and building a new website and filming a ton of content. So it's keeping me busy.
How surprised were you when the URL baseeducation.com was still available?
I know. A couple of years ago, my wife and I were just kicking around the idea. I'd been thinking about it already for a while, and we just started kind of bored, you know, just flipping through URLs. And when that became available, we just figured we had to buy it. We kind of couldn't believe it. So I've been sitting on it for years.
Yeah, and now you're finally working on it.
Yeah.
Cool. I want to take it back a little bit to the beginning. I always start my podcast episode with two questions. The first one is important. And I usually do this with a guest that has a bass on their lap, and we can, you know, you can play examples of something. But I was checking out some material of yours, and I have the impression that you have a taste for, let's say, unorthodox bass models. Am I correct?
Well, I met a luthier named Pete Schold. I had always been in search of the bass that just felt right and sounded the way I wanted it to sound. I was kind of chasing a sound for forever, it seems like. And I met Pete probably 13, 14 years ago, and his instruments just really resonated with me. So it's not so much that I like unique and strange instruments. I just love his work. So I pretty much play nothing but his basses, except for the odd, you know, Fender Mustang for certain gigs and certain sessions. You know, there's certain tools I'll use for certain jobs, but 99% of the time I'm playing one of my Scholds.
So it's pronounced Schold.
Yeah, I had it wrong at first. I thought it was Skjold, or, you know, but Schold.
And is it Norwegian or something?
Yeah. His family hails from that region. I'm sure it probably was pronounced a little differently there. I'm not sure.
Definitely. I think my Norwegian is probably as good as yours.
Ah, good. That makes me feel better.
So, what was your first bass when you started out?
Fender Bullet.
Right.
Yeah.
The smaller precision kind of thing.
Yeah.
Pickup, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think I got that when I was maybe 6 or 7 years old in the late 70s, maybe 1980. And that was my bass for a long time. And interesting, you know, it was set up horribly, and I didn't know any better. My action was like an inch off of the fretboard, and I was trying to learn Teen Town and all that kind of stuff. So I guess I built up some good finger endurance.
You were trying to learn Teen Town when you were 7 years old, or was it a lot later?
Maybe 8 or 9. My grandfather, he had me working hard every day, and he used to just bring in all kinds of music because he wanted me to be able to read as well.
Right.
But he loved all things jazz and fusion. So he'd bring me Eddie Gomez solos to learn and Jaco bass lines transcribed to learn. And I didn't know any better. So I just got to work and slowly figured him out. I probably couldn't play him till I was in my early teens, but I was working on him pretty early on.
So what made you pick the bass? Was it your grandfather was like, hey, Damien, maybe it's a good idea if you start playing bass?
Yeah, literally. He just bought me that bass and said, here, you're going to learn how to do this. Made me practice an hour a day. And honestly, I hated it for the longest time.
Yeah, because I read in an, I think in an interview that the bass was your first instrument, but the drums was your first love.
Yeah, exactly. My uncle Peter Erskine is a jazz drummer, and he had given me one of his kits when I was 10. And I got to explore that freely on my own, and I just fell in love. And actually quit playing bass altogether at about 12 or 13 and didn't pick it up again until I was in my early 20s.
And then you picked the bass up again when you were already at Berkeley, right?
Yeah, I was a drum major, a drum principal at Berkeley. But I was a little metalhead. You know, I just didn't know what I was doing in a jazz school. And I kind of started checking out some of the music Peter had given me, you know, tapes of John Scofield and old Weather Report stuff, and kind of thought, wow, these bass players are pretty happening. So I thought, hey, I'm in a jazz school. Maybe I should study a harmonic instrument. And I switched my major to bass and picked it up for the first time in 7 or 8 years. And I had a lot of catching up to do and kind of got my butt kicked, but it stuck.
Yeah, oh, definitely. It definitely stuck. when you were like figuring out all that Jaco Pastorius and the jazz fusion stuff on that Squire, oh, that Fender Bullet bass, did you realize that the sound was so different? You were like, wait a second, I can kind of play these lines, but I have to find a sound that's more suitable for this music?
I didn't really become aware of sound. The sound of my bass until I picked it up again at 20. I maybe wound up getting halfway there because a lot of that stuff you can only, at least for me, I wound up playing back by the bridge out of necessity just because it was easier to play fast back there because the tension's higher. So I kind of lucked into a little bit of it, but I never really thought about sound and feel a whole lot until I was a little bit older. I used to, especially because drums were my first instrument, I used to play with rhythm a lot. So I mainly had fun with rhythm on the instrument. You know, if he was having me practice scales, I would play around with rhythm as a way to make those scales interesting.
Yeah, I read, I think one of your last columns for No Treble was about playing, like having fun with rhythm while playing bass.
Yeah, because for me, at least, the rhythmic language was my first language. I that was the thing I resonated with, and I always thought rhythmically. Harmonically was something, you know, thinking harmonically was something I had to work at. So, you know, my grandfather was holding me accountable and making me play him what I had been practicing and making sure I had that scale down better than I did the day before. So the only way I could just not go crazy sitting there playing a scale over and over again for an hour was to start playing with rhythmic groupings and subdivisions and things like that. I didn't know what they were called at the time, but that's what I wound up doing with them.
You just played what you felt was fun to play around with.
Yeah, exactly. Trying to make a scale sound kind of funky or sound like something I had heard, you know, some style of music, make it swing, make it funky, make it Latin, anything, you know, just do something with it rhythmically.
Do you think that's an underestimated automatic scale for bass players? Like maybe bass players tend to think more harmonically or melodically. How do you view that in like the bass player community?
I think it is. I mean, you know, everybody gets there eventually, but I do find that a lot of my students have never really thought about rhythm, which is understandable. You know, you're kind of inundated with harmonic materials early on, and so you really focus on those scales and arpeggios and, you know, how to play a bass line, but you're always focused on the notes. It's almost as if rhythm is just a byproduct of learning other people's bass lines and melodic ideas. But I really resonated with the idea of thinking about rhythm, continuing to think about rhythm like a drummer on the bass, and really still studying rhythm as its own separate entity, and then combining it together with harmony to come up with more interesting things.
Do you feel that approach has changed over the years that you've been a teacher now?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, it's tricky when you're teaching because there is a certain amount of harmonic foundation that you really need to try and reinforce in people. But I also try and reinforce the my impression that all the right notes and all the good notes in the world won't save you if it doesn't feel good.
Of course.
And feel is all about, is really rhythm and phrasing, you know, note length and vibrato and dynamics and all of that kind of stuff. To me, the notes, the note choices are tertiary. They're third in line.
Yeah.
So I tend to push the foundational harmony, but also really get people focusing on what they're playing and try and get them to always play musically no matter what they're doing. If you're going to play a scale, make it sound good. Make the notes sound good. Make, you know, make it sing as much as you can.
I think that's a very important lesson for many bass players. Even when practicing, please make it sound good.
Yeah, you know, you're practicing playing musically. So you should always be trying to play musically.
There is a question from a viewer, even two. Arjan, I think he's a big fan because he says it's great to have Damien Erskine on the live stream, which it is. He says two questions. The first one is, how did you land the gig with Gino Vannelli?
Ah, well, Gino actually lives in this area. His wife is from Portland. So I had already been playing with everybody in his band for some time. And something came up and he had me come over to the studio and just play along to some tunes. And I wound up recording A Good Thing, one of Gino's albums. Mm-hmm. And then it was, a little less than a year later, he had me do some gigs. And I've been touring with him for the past 10 years.
So it was basically more or less coincidence that you were hanging out and playing with his band members.
Yeah, just word of mouth, you know, when it looked like his bass player might be moving, a guy named Sandon Wilson, another local guy, great player. Gino just asked everybody in the band, who do you think could do this? You know, because Gino's very demanding and, he likes a certain thing and he likes people to be able to play a certain way. And they all gave him my name and said, this is probably the other guy in town if you want anybody. So it worked out.
Yeah, and it still does. His second question, which is, I think, interesting in line with the musical practicing that you just talked about. He said, how would you approach learning to play horn-like, between brackets, bebop-style solos? Which is a huge question, I think, but maybe it's a good thing to point out where to start if you want to be more like a horn player when phrasing in solos.
Well, listen to a lot of horn players. And transcribe. You know, I got away from studying with bass players maybe 15, 20 years ago when I realized, you know, if I want to learn to play melodically, I need to kind of go right to the source, go to the guys who are the musicians who are trained to think melodically from day one. You know, I started going to horn players and piano players and taking lessons with them and pick their brains about how they thought about harmony. And transcription is huge, learning the vocabulary. And, you know, transcription goes far beyond just figuring out what notes and in what order they fall. You really need to look at the changes and look at the lines they're playing and see how they relate to get a sense of how that person is seeing the lines they're playing through that harmony. You're trying to see the music through somebody else's eyes, so you need to dig a little deep. Sorry. That's transcription and analysis is huge. And then, you know, just practicing when it comes, I've never really resonated with the bebop sound. I'm always pretty amazed at it. But I know, you know, just practicing chromatic approaches, you know, even taking arpeggios and practicing approaching each note from a half step below and a half step above. And, you know, it can really just start to creak the door open just a little bit into that world, because that's really what it's all about, is setting target notes and then how you're going to get from here to there and how you're going to approach those notes and getting comfortable with chromaticism in that context.
Right. So, and how do you use... I mean, I personally, when I want to feel a melody or something that I'm trying to be more melodically in my solos or in any aspect of my playing, I tend to sing along a lot with what I'm doing, because being vocal really helps in translating what you're feeling or what you're hearing to your bass. Do you feel the same way?
Yeah, and especially, you know, when I first started playing around with that, I've realized after a while that I was simply trying to sing what I was already going to play, and I was still playing my normal stuff. I kind of had a little bit of a breakthrough with it when I really stopped and slowed down and tried to just sing some lines and then tried to start playing what I wanted to sing. It's a subtle shift, but it was an important shift for me. Trying for the voice to come from the inside out and not the other way.
Right.
So it can be very helpful. And often, if I'm watching a video, I'll realize I've noticed in myself whenever I get frustrated with an idea falls apart, I immediately stop and start singing along with myself. Because it's just become kind of a natural inclination that when I need to reconnect with the music, I try and do it vocally as well.
So you really, really implemented that in your playing.
Yeah, at least, I guess so, because it's kind of a subconscious thing. I know I can tell when I get frustrated with an idea because I immediately start singing.
Is that like... is it weird to see that? Like, oh yeah, I'm rewatching my stuff and I can feel or hear this is the moment where I kind of got stuck in my own phrasing.
Yeah, it always makes me giggle because there's usually a facial expression that accompanies it.
As does every bass player.
Yeah.
I'm seeing your books behind you on your right hand shoulder.
Oh yeah, sorry, unintentional product placement.
Right.
Yeah, sure. I spent all morning lining that up.
I was checking out some of your videos, and I found that you seem to use two different right hand techniques, at least two. You have the three finger picking.
Yeah.
And then there's also, I mean, when I play, I put my thumb on the pickup or on like the lowest string, whether it's a B or an E string or whatever, and then keep it there. But I have the feeling that you move your thumb all the way, so it's always one string away from
exactly
fingers.
Yeah. I've just that position is really comfortable for me, so I've just always had this movable thumb when I play with two fingers. And then I also, of course, with the three fingers, I use my thumb a lot in conjunction with the other two, and I also palm mute quite a bit. So it's kind of two and a half techniques.
So do you have is it an automatic process which one you pick, or is it a conscious thing like, oh, when I'm playing like more melodically, or I know when you're going to palm mute a lot that you're using the three finger technique? How does that work in your head?
It's automatic now. At this point, it's all about the sound. As soon as I go to produce a certain sound, my hand just does what it needs to do in order to facilitate that. Sometimes it's a feel thing. I feel lines differently when I'm playing with my thumb and, you know, with three fingers versus just playing finger style. And it's a combination of feel and sound. But it's pretty unconscious at this point. My hand just does what it needs to do.
Maybe a bit much to ask because you don't have a bass at the moment, but is it possible to show the difference, like, or make clear how the sound is?
I'm sorry. I should have brought a bass in here with me. I didn't think about it. So I first started playing around with a three finger technique because I was frustrated with the sound of a bass on a tour, and so I wound up palm muting everything. Mm-hmm. And the tour happened to be with a banjo player, kind of a bottleneck slide guitar / banjo player named Tony Furtado, and I started picking his brain about three finger patterns and rolls so I could get more comfortable because my thumb didn't have nearly the muscle memory that these fingers did. So I essentially just kind of hold my hand in this position, and whether I'm palm muting or just plucking, and I usually anchor with my thumb, so sometimes I kind of wind up doing that. I mean anchor with my pinky, sorry.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just a very organic feeling. What's nice about it is that when the bass is laying on my body, and sorry, the camera's so high, so I have to do it up here, it actually puts my plucking hand in a much more natural and ergonomic position. My wrist is nice and straight. My hand just lays right on the string. And I've just found it to be supremely comfortable for my hand Also, if you notice, you know, if you're just kind of walking along and you hold your hand up, there's kind of a nice natural arch in the fingers. We don't tend to do that. And that's exactly the position that my hand is in when I'm playing with my thumb. It's just a nice straight wrist, nice natural curve to the fingers. And it's just, yeah, it's just so comfortable. That's my kind of go-to position.
Yeah, and it's kind of, it makes me think a bit of the Gary Willis technique. Only that he uses five fingers.
Well, Matt Garrison uses four. Gary Willis uses primarily three, and he has a floating thumb.
Oh, right, that's it.
Yeah, so his thumb's always on top of the strings, and he plays primarily with these fingers. I don't know if I've ever seen him play with his pinky. I'm not sure.
Wow, I always thought he was also plucking with his thumb, but that's a floating...
Yeah, floating technique. It's just kind of like laying on the strings or just above them. I've tried that for a while, and it just did not feel comfortable for me.
No, I have exactly the same thing. I need to have an anchor when playing, whether it's my thumb or my pinky or whatever.
Yeah, and that's the interesting thing. And I teach a lot of technique with students, and I always implore people to explore, because everybody's physiology is different. What works for me is not going to be exactly what works for you. You need to experiment and find out where your comfort zone is and what your body wants to do and how it wants to interact with the instrument. So everybody's a little different.
So how do you approach that then with a student? Like, he either uses the floating thumb technique or has the technique. How do you approach like correcting the technique of a student without interfering in how he feels he needs to play?
Well, I don't tend to do much correction per se, unless I see them doing something that I think might lead to, you know, injury or discomfort, really severe wrist cranks, and, you know, people get some weird angles here and there. But for the most part, I just try and incorporate the things I teach to them in their own way. It focuses, like, you know, in the right hand drive book thing, when I got into that technique, I got very into exploring every variation, every variable. So I didn't have to start with this finger or that finger, and I didn't have to approach things in any certain way, because I wanted to be able to use everything in whatever way made sense for the situation. So I used to do things like practice playing a scale up and down. I'd choose a fingering, maybe thumb 1 2 thumb 1 2, but then practice playing every note once in the scale. So I'm constantly changing strings with different fingers, and then play every note two times, three, four. I did 1 through 7 for everything. So it really helps you to adapt the technique and internalize it. So now when I play, I don't need to think about what finger I'm using. I just use whatever finger makes the most sense for the line.
Whichever is available.
Yeah, exactly.
I want to take it back a little bit to the beginning. You told me that you were fed the Jaco Pastorius stuff when you were young and you started out. How long did it take for you to like go out and discover your own stuff and the things you were into?
Well, with regard to the bass, I didn't really start developing any sense of a voice until my, mid to late 20s, maybe even into my 30s. When I was a kid, bass was just something my grandfather made me do. I never even played with other people. I just practiced in my bedroom. It wasn't something I wanted to do. It wasn't something I was interested in. It was just something I had to do, as opposed to drums, where I played with everybody I could, and I kind of had my own thing with that. On the bass, I didn't really start studying in earnest until my mid-20s. And so, harmonically and actually transcribing other players and really thinking about what I was doing on the instrument.
Yeah.
Yeah, so my voice, your voice on the instrument is the conglomeration of everything you've ever done on the instrument. You know, if you've got super into Victor Wooten, there'll be a little bit of that in there, but you're always going to have other stuff in there as well, because you've listened to this music and you've practiced things in a different way. So it's just after you've done so much work, you kind of can't help but to have a little bit of your own approach to things.
But when you came back to the bass, you somehow made that choice, like, hey, I'm going to see if I can still pick this up again and see what happens. Who are the guys you were checking out then when you
got back into it?
Instrument? Yeah.
Yeah, well, Jocko, because he was one of the – I mean, I got to see him play a lot when I was a kid too through Peter. So I had a ton of recordings and video recordings. My grandfather used to videotape gigs once in a while, weather report gigs. And I discovered Victor Wooten in college, and I was a Victor nut. Victor Wooten and Oteil Burbidge were kind of my two guys through most of my 20s. Then I got into, Richard Bona, different people like that. And then through studying jazz, I actually started to really appreciate jazz. And then I started listening to Mark Johnson and Dave Holland and guys like that. But it was when I studied, I knew that I wanted to play music for a living. And I knew that I would likely wind up being a freelance musician, and the idea appealed to me. I liked the idea of being able to just jump into any situation and play that thing. So I started exploring a lot of other musics, and whenever I would play that music, I would always kind of have a player in mind. When I first started playing in salsa bands, I used to think, what would Anthony Jackson was my first reference point for how an electric player would play that kind of music. His work with Michel Camillo and stuff like that. Yeah. But then I got into John Benitez and Oscar Stagnaro and guys like that. So I always have a player in mind when I'm playing, 60s, 50s, 60s, 70s swing type stuff. I'm really trying to emulate a bass player and trying to hear a bass player in my head. So, when I'm doing my own thing, I'm just thinking about my own thing. But when I'm playing other music, I'm always kind of hearing the sound of whatever my gold standard is, whatever person that is for that style, and kind of having that in the back of my mind.
Yeah, but and is it then difficult to still find your own thing within that? I mean, when I play, for example, when I play reggae music, I'll always think of Robbie Shakespeare. But I also then find that it's hard for me to like find my own thing within that style. Is that an automatic thing, or how does that work?
I think that's an automatic thing that will organically evolve. The more you do something, the more you find your own way of doing it. When you first learn anything, you have to learn how other people did it before you can start to grasp the concept and get a sense of how you might do that thing. So I think it's just something that organically evolves as you gain more and more experience with that thing.
Great. Sounds great. I was checking out some stuff, and I know you from the Schult bass, like the 5-string kind of bright sounding bass. The maple, I think it's a maple top and maple neck and everything.
That's a 4-string, the maple one. One of the things with Schold was that he helped me get away from the super bright sounding thing. So I hope it doesn't sound too bright.
but it's still like, it sounds like a modern bass. It doesn't sound like a vintage Fender.
Yeah. And I actually have fallen away from using that bass specifically because of that. I've lately been using, I basically have two primary basses that I play. I have 4 Scholds overall. I have 1 6-string that I use pretty exclusively with Gino Vannelli, just because they really like the sound of it. It's got a little bit more of an edge to the sound. What's that?
Is that the single cut bass?
That's the it's Box Elder. That's the really light colored, the blonde single cut bass.
Right.
But my two primary basses for almost everything else are either a similar single cut 6-string, which is very warm and kind of organic, almost like a jazz guitar kind of sound, or a model called the Grayling, which is kind of it's got a rounded body. I don't know if you've seen that one, but that's very much more of an old school bass. I have tape wound strings on there. It's almost kind of like, it looks like an old Gibson Ripper or something.
Right. Right. And it only has one pickup and it's a 4-string.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that bass.
If you kind of follow your sound, it's a bit, well, let's not say weird, but it's like out of the ordinary to see you with like a big bass with one pickup and then to tape on strings. How did you end up with that?
Well, I don't know. Things have just kind of naturally evolved. I mean, at this point, all of my basses are passive. A lot of them have that one big pickup in the middle, but there's actually two soap bars in there. So my I have volume, tone controls.
Right.
And I favor the bridge, I mean, the neck pickup sound at this point in my playing. So I've just kind of started evolving backwards, getting more and more old school sensibilities. I don't know why necessarily. I just always loved. I mean, really, my ideal bass sound is an upright.
Right.
I love that sound. It's just never been a comfortable instrument for me. I've kind of tried to find my happy place in between as an electric player and find something that's nice and warm and round, but can still be articulate without being overly brittle or bright. I've never been a big sound of that kind of glassy, super bright tone. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking for, George Porter Jr., you know.
Now, why not get a precision bass?
I've never found one that I like to play.
Is it then the neck or the...
It's, I shouldn't say that. I have found one. I love my Mustang, and I play that on a lot of things as well. I have found one precision that I liked and one jazz bass that I really liked. Both of them were vintage and incredibly expensive, so I never bought them. If I had them, I would probably play them a lot.
What year is your Mustang? Or is it a new one?
It's a new one. It's a reissue. I bought it off Kerry Nordstrand.
Oh, great.
He was using it as a demo bass to mm-hmm. develop pickup replacements for it. And so it has his pickup in it. And I don't know. It's a Japanese reissue or something. I don't know exactly what it is, but I love that thing. Yeah.
I'm always coming back to Jaco somehow. And me also being a big Jaco fan, when I was, I think I was 10 years old, I knew I wanted to have a fretless. What is your vision on fretless playing? Do you use it? Do you have one?
I do. I have a 5-string fretless Zaun that is truly incredible. I have one fretless bass. I use it primarily on recording sessions. I love the sound of the fretless bass. I think it's such an emotive sound. I perceive fretless playing as a much more vocal expression of music on the electric instrument. Mm-hmm. But I've just spent so much of my life playing fretted instruments, and I'm reading so much on my gigs. I found reading on a fretless, I inevitably start to drift a little bit. And somehow my playing style doesn't feel as comfortable. I shouldn't say it doesn't feel as comfortable on a fretless bass, but I don't know. It's just a different thing. I love the fretless thing on certain gigs, but I don't like to read really heavily on it. And I feel like my approach and everything is just so tailored to the fretted instrument that I tend not to grab it that often.
Just, okay. You mentioned reading. I personally have the feeling that reading music has become, for especially like pop musicians, like guitar players, drummers, bass players, has become less important in the last, I think, 10 to 15 years. Many bass players of my age can read properly, and many young players, I have the feeling the younger players tend to read worse than I do. Do you see that development as well?
Maybe. most of the students that come through my door don't read that well. There's, you know, or maybe not proficient enough sight readers to just get thrown a book of relatively complicated music on a gig and be able to survive it. I don't know. I've always tell my students, I've never been one to believe that everybody needs to learn how to read or that everybody needs to do anything, really. But I do try and implore people to project into the future and think about what they want to do with the instrument. You know, if you want to be a freelance session guy, I don't mean to keep being gender specific, but a freelance session person, or you know, anything of that ilk, you need to learn how to read. So if your vision for your musical life involves that on any level, it's folly not to get into it as early as possible. But you know, for folks who just want to, they're just songwriters and they just want to have their band, or they just want to play with their friends in the garage on the weekends, or they just want to, you know, join a pop band or a rock band or blues band, that, you know, it's maybe not the most necessary thing to work on. It all kind of depends what you want to do on the instrument.
Do you actually teach bass players to read? Like, okay, you're not a big reader, you want to be a session musician, here's a couple of like sheets, go ahead and have fun.
I mean, I have, certainly when I teach college, you know, I teach at Portland State University, and I have a student at Portland Community College as well. Yeah, then I start pushing them to read and giving them cello suites, and Oscar Stagnaro's Latin Bass Book is a great book to read through. So things of that ilk. Generally, most of the students that I work with remotely or come here when they're allowed to are more intermediate and advanced players, and a lot of guys that might be on the road actually and coming through town and want to grab a quick lesson, or if I'm on the road, I'll grab lessons, you know, people grab lessons with me. So most of those people are pretty much have their thing dialed in. They know what that is, and they just want a little, you know, push in one direction or another, some ideas to help open some more doors. I don't tend to work with beginning students all that often. So usually when it comes to learning how to read, I prefer not to start at the beginning.
Okay, so you have a good start, now come to me.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, really, there's no big secret to learning how to read, but it is a skill. It is one of the more use it or lose it type skills out there. You really need to do it even a little bit every day. Yeah. Because it's a lot of internalization of graphical representations of music. You know, you need to internalize what a C looks like there, and then build upon that every day, and keep working out where the open strings are and the thing. You know, as soon as you put it down for a week, you've kind of half forgotten everything you learned the week prior. So it does take dedication. And I do tell people that if you really want to learn how to do this, you need to get to work and learn how to do this. And there's only two ways I know of to learn how to read, and that's to start reading a lot of music or start writing a lot of music. You know, notating things, notating transcriptions, figuring out how to notate different rhythms and where the notes are. And that's really it. You just have to do it.
You mentioned between the lines when people are allowed to come here. Is there a strict door rule within your studio?
No, well, I mean, technically, there's room. I could have somebody 6 feet away, but at this point, I'm just not interested in having anybody come over to the house.
That's logical.
Interestingly, I mean, a couple of weeks ago, I had two different people hit me up about remote lessons, and I, you know, wrote them my little spiel about what it entails, and I said, you know, we can use the platform of your choice, Skype, Zoom, whatever, and they wrote back and said, you know, I'm not really interested in remote lessons. And I just said, well, you're gonna have to wait. Now is not the time.
Do you really think I'm going to give you a lesson one-on-one? So do you do a lot of remote lessons?
A fair amount. I mean, you know, every week I tend to have 3 to 5 Skype lessons on the books. It comes and goes, comes in waves. It's never been something that I've pushed especially hard to foster, but I'm always happy to try and help people out, and you know, I couldn't ask for more. It's my studio's 10 feet from my kitchen, so
that's always a good place to have a studio.
Yeah, there's always coffee, and then you know, I'm here, so
what do you feel is a big difference between like remote lessons and one-on-one?
remote lessons are tough. I mean, even platforms like Zoom, where they can support a certain amount of bidirectional audio, mm-hmm. You still can't really play together. So it's a lot of like, okay, I'll go talk about it. Okay, you go. And then you try and listen through the speakers and you can't, you know, you can never hear it as well as you can in the room. So it winds up being, I wind up feeling like it's almost more of a lecture class thing.
Right.
You know, where I explain concepts and provide materials and say, okay, here's how you work on this thing. I'll do it for a while, show them what it sounds like, try and get them to do it and hear as best as I can and make some suggestions. But it winds up being a one at a time kind of interaction, as opposed to just really being able to sit and play through some ideas with somebody and look at their finger and like point right to their fretboard and say, no, try this, you know.
Yeah. And then interrupt them.
It'll never take the place. Yeah, and interrupt them.
That's always the hardest thing. I had a student yesterday and he did something brilliant. I was going to say, wait, that was brilliant. And he just didn't hear what I was saying. He was like, yeah, go ahead. So how was it? Yeah, you did something brilliant, but now I forgot what it was.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's always a little awkward. But, you know, especially for people who live in remote areas or maybe don't have access to the teacher they want, you know, it's a fantastic outlet. I certainly wish I could have done it when I was younger.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
What was the biggest disappointment in a bass you ever had? Like when you bought one, you were like, no, I should never have gotten this.
I've never had that. Well, I can't think of any basses that I've bought that I've regretted. But the first thing that came to mind was, are you familiar with Rich Brown?
Doesn't ring a bell.
He's a phenomenal bass player. He's one of my favorite bass players of all time. Lives in Toronto. Played in a band called Dap Theory for a long time, also a band called Auto Rickshaw, and he played with Steve Coleman. He does it all. Really unique voice on the instrument, phenomenal player. And anyway, he was coming through town. He was in Portland, and I got to hang out with him, and he actually came over to the house, and I was totally starstruck. I know, I've just been completely in love with this guy for years. And I was like, oh, you got to let me play your bass. You know, you've got the best sound in the world. I need to hear that under my fingers. And I picked up his bass and I was just like, God damn it, I don't sound anything like you. I still just sounded like me on his bass. And I was like, he picked up my bass and he still sounded exactly like him. And it was one of the more disappointing. I was like, okay, so it's not the gear. Fine.
It's really the fingers.
Yeah.
And still, we bass players tend to buy lots of gear because they sound so different.
They do, but you're always going to sound like you. You know, I have maybe six or seven basses, two that I play most of the time. And all of those other basses are for specific requirements in the studio. If somebody's looking for a certain thing, I know to grab this bass over this bass. They're all different tools, but I always sound like me, and I can't get away from it. No matter how much I want to sound like Jamerson here and Jocko here and Jimmy Johnson here or Sheree Reed here, you know, God damn it, I'm always going to sound like me.
But I think it might also be like a good thing because people call you because they want somebody that sounds like you.
Yeah, no, I've certainly made peace with it.
And you're referring to like when you're channeling your inner Jamerson when you're playing a Motown thing, or channeling your inner Jocko when you play a jazz fusion gig. You'll all sound like you, but then a little bit more Jamerson-ish or Jocko-ish, perhaps.
Yeah, you know, it comes down to, you know, it might manifest in more of a phrasing or no choice or use of space, you know, not over articulating things rhythmically when I'm playing on a salsa gig and things like that, where my natural tendency might be to really feel all those subdivisions and kind of imply them all.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm channeling Anthony Jackson or John Benitez or Oscar or any one of those guys, I'm thinking, okay, no, like this is, everybody's got a part and it fits in the puzzle and this is the approach I'll take, but I'm still going to sound like me when I do it to a certain degree.
Great. That sounds like a great advice. A lot of my viewers and listeners always want to know about pedals. I'm not a big pedal fan myself, but what's your view on effects and pedals? Do you have like a huge pedal board or a couple for different occasions?
No, I'm very much a plug and play kind of guy. I just like plugging into the amp and going. But I do have a little mini, you know, pedal train nano that I have loaded with a few pedals for certain gigs. If I was to only ever use one, it would certainly be an octave pedal. I use the MXR Octaver.
That's the blue one, right?
Yeah, it's the blue one. I found, you know, I really like the Boss OC2 is a classic, and the Aguilar Octaver is fantastic. I always come back to that MXR just because it tracks so well, and it's got that mid-boost button that really helps it cut through the mix. And if you want to do the sub-bass thing with just the lower octave, you know, it just tracks really well and sounds good. I tend to use, when I use the Octaver, my tendency is to have mostly dry sound with a little bit of octave underneath. So it's almost, sometimes it can almost sound like an overdrive a little bit, you know, just thickens it up. In addition to that, I have a reverb, little TC Electronics Hall of Fame, I think it's called, the little mini pedal reverb. Yep. That I like for, you know, maybe solos just to help fill the space a little bit and make notes sing a little bit more. I don't like to overdo it. Gino likes things really washed in reverb, so I use that pedal a lot on that gig. And then I have an overdrive pedal, a dark glass, that I pretty much only use on with a guy named Skarik on the Skarik band gigs, is, you know, for more aggressive. He's every once in a while, I know, I like to kick on the overdrive on that gig. But for the most part, I just plug into the amp and go.
Great. That sounds like my kind of bass player. I see on the one hand of your screen is your books, and on the other hand, I see two amplifiers. Now, the one I can see what it is. It's an Aguilar Tonehammer 500.
700, but yeah.
You're endorsed by Aguilar, right?
Yeah, I'm an Aguilar guy for 15 years now. I love those amps. And that cabinet, usually all my Aguilar gear lives on a shelf for easy loading into the car. This amp, the cabinet there, is a Walter Woods cabinet. I didn't even know he made those, but I inherited some of my biological father's bass gear. He was a bass player in the Stan Kenton Orchestra for years. And among the gear I wound up coming home with was a Walter Woods, like a 73 Walter Woods head, and a Woods amp, a Woods cabinet, which I didn't know existed. So normally in my studio, that's kind of my live sound rig for rehearsals and stuff. But the Walter Woods head recently crapped out, so I kind of went and grabbed the Aguilar and brought it in here and plugged it into that.
Right. So that's a bit of an oddity. And then there's a Fender. Is it a Champ?
Yeah, it's a Champ. That's a great little amp. I mean, this studio is mainly for my use and for teaching and rehearsals. I have a little drum set over here as well. And I never intended to have a guitar amp, but I was doing a recording session, a guitar-led band, and he needed one more day, and he hit me up. He said, I just need, you know, maybe half a day more in the studio, but I'm running low on dough. Could I give you this amp?
Wow.
Yeah, great. It'd be great. Man, that thing sounds great.
Yeah, and it's tiny. Is it
exactly?
It's an early 70s, I think, from this distance.
I have no idea.
Great.
it probably is, though. He is a guy who tends to buy a lot of old gear and then fix it up and then resell it, and then he keeps what he really likes and then sells everything else. So I imagine that is an older Champ.
Cool. Do you play guitar yourself? I mean, you play drums and then bass and.
No. I learned a you know, a Stairway to Heaven in college, in high school, and Blackbird, and that's about as far as I got on the guitar.
Yeah, that's enough to impress, you know, the lady types.
You know, I have always really wanted to get a widely spaced baritone guitar that I could tune like my six-string bass.
Right.
So I could just kind of sit and experiment with chord shapes and things. But most guitars, it's, you know, the strings are too small and they're too close together. It just feels, it's weird for me.
And then he bought a Mustang, speaking of all instruments.
I do love that short scale thing, though. I mean, even my Scholds, even my six strings are 33-inch. But man, there's some, that 30-inch is just fun to play.
How do you feel the B string behaves on that 33? I mean, it's an amazingly built bass, I can imagine. But do you feel that scale length has a lot of influence on the tightness and on the sound of a B string?
Not if it's well made. It sounds fantastic on those, and I've also played a friend's 30-inch scale Callowhill string, and the B string on that was crushing too. So I think as long as they're made with love, care, and attention, it can be done for sure. The thing I love about my six string Catacomb Schold is that it's completely even from the lowest note to the highest note. Nothing jumps out. Nothing gets crispy or gets buried. Turn my heater was about to go on. It's kind of a loud fan. It can definitely be done.
As long as it's well built.
Yeah, and I've also found I prefer the sound of shorter scale instruments. It seems to me, you know, speaking of Anthony Jackson, he talks about, you know, piano-like clarity of 35 and 36 inch scale instruments. I was talking to Pete Schold and I said, you know, I feel like I can never get the sound I want out of 35 inch scale instruments. And it turns out there's a little bit of natural distortion that happens on shorter scale basses when you get to 33 and below. It's distortion is maybe too strong a word. It's almost like more of a growl.
Yeah.
Just a little bit.
Mustang's so amazing.
Yeah, a little bit of grit. It's a natural byproduct of the strings vibrating more, and maybe, you know, hitting frets. I don't know what, but so I've actually really I prefer the sound of shorter scale basses.
Cool, Damien. If there's one advice you can give to the Dutch bass players that are listening or viewing at the moment, what does it have to be? The one thing they have to take from this whole hour long conversation?
It's twofold. I would say, you know, if you're early in your development, take the time to build a nice strong foundation and then work slowly and with intention to always build nice stronger layers on top of that foundation so you can, you know, travel higher and go further by virtue of not leaving gaps in your development and skipping over things that you just don't want to do because they'll come back to bite you in the butt later on. But for anybody, as universal advice, my advice is always to practice well, practice slowly, practice with intention. Hit all of the variables, really explore what you're doing, and always play musically. You know, play with a good sound, good technique, and just internalize everything as much as you can. Don't just, you know, get to the races and start trying to play as fast as you can and blaze through exercises and think, yeah, I got it, next. Because then you wind up either practicing sloppy technique or approach, or most likely just not really building that strong foundation. So you wind up having to come back later on and relearn all kinds of stuff you took for granted.
Great. That sounds like an advice everybody can start practicing with.
Yeah, I have to remind myself constantly to take my own advice. It's
don't we all?
Yeah.
You know, I want to thank you so much for being my guest, and I hope we'll meet somewhere in the future when everything's back to normal.
Back to normal. Well, if we do indeed wind up coming through that way with Gino Vannelli in October and November, I'll definitely hit you up. We'll have to meet in person.
Great. Thank you, man.
Thank you so much for having me, brother.
Thank you for being here.
All right, take care.
You were listening to the interview I had with Damien Erskine. Did you like this podcast? Subscribe in your favorite podcast medium. Leave a review on iTunes. And don't forget to subscribe to the Basgaster Playlist on Spotify. And leave a message on the Basgaster Facebook page. This was the last episode of Season 1. I will hopefully see you in September. See you then.
Thanks for the buff. That was the boss.